the laughter has already started indicating that we're not even 20 seconds into the new season of Mention and Dispatches, and Mirth is already drunk. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I am not as drunk as I need to be.
Well, that are you saying that Vance causes, you know, drives you to drink? Howdy, Vance.
Howdy.
Is this just trying to keep up with the Canadian? Is that what we're after here?
He's an honorary Canadian.
Yeah. I mean, he lives north of parts of Canada, so, you know, there is
That's true.
So, yeah, the new season of Mention and Dispatches is here kicking things off, and one of the major things going on in the wargaming world right now was going to be the primary topic of tonight's show, and that is everybody's big-ass boxes of World at War 85 Kickstarter stuff have been showing up on their porches. The folks in England are even starting to get theirs. By the time we read this, Judge Dredd might have finally opened the box.
I wouldn't count on that.
Well, that's true. It probably, with his luck, it accidentally got delivered to the neighbor, and the neighbor's busy trying to figure out what the hell all this stuff is. Vance, I think of the three of us, you actually got your stuff first.
Yeah, weird, eh?
Yeah. That said, Chris and I think, are done paying for ours. Just had to twist that knife there a little bit.
Bring that up.
So for folks that don't know what we're talking about, it was, I mean, it's a year and a half ago at this point that David started the Kickstarter for the World at War 85 reboot, right?
Yep.
It was back in 2018 when they launched the Kickstarter. And like, it was funded in, what, 48 hours or something ridiculous? And they kept adding stretch goals. So the World at War 85 series is the update to the original Lock and Load World at War, Cold War Goes Hot in Europe in the mid-80s series. And the relaunch, the first box was Storm in the Gap, was the relaunch of the game. And so that's U.S. versus Russians in the Fold the Gap. And as a part of the Kickstarter, there were multiple expansions that were added on. There was the solo battle generator that was added on. There was a novel that was added on and then somehow managed to make the ship move slower coming across the ocean because, you know, somebody writing a novel nowhere near China slowed a ship down coming from China. Giant neoprene playmat for folks that ordered them. There was this oversized, like a wall size poster map of the Fold the Gap. There's the Drive on Giessen campaign.
If you want to play the game as a minis game, they've included that content.
Yep. Yep, that's right. They included all the stat cards so you could play the thing as a minis game. Vance, you've actually laid it all out on the table and put it all to use at some point. What have I missed? Did I cover everything?
There's the campaign expansion.
Yeah, the Drive on Giessen.
Campaign expansion. There's the solo expansion.
Let's not talk about that, but
there's the, I haven't even opened that box yet.
My solo expansion thing is still in the shrink wrap. I've opened all the other stuff.
Yeah, I opened this solo stuff. I'm never going to play it, but I opened it. So.
Why did you open it?
There is some irony here in Chris being the guy that's unwrapped the solo expansion.
I just wanted to look at everything that I got. I'm sorry.
So I've already started punching and playing some. Vance, I think you've got a whole lot more games into this than I have. Chris, I think you guys were trying to figure out when you could schedule your group for a couple of the minis games.
We played an intro scenario. We're trying to figure the rest of it out.
Okay, so
we actually do want to play this thing. So
I think, Vance, right now you're more games in than the rest of us. Give us the impressions. Give us what you think. Because you've played the original one also, so you've got some good basis of comparison here. Let's talk about for a brand new person who never touched the original series, sort of what are they getting themselves into? And then, you know, in a minute or so, we'll take a second, talk about some comparisons to the original one. Go.
well, it's really fast playing, easy to learn, platoon level, World War III game. You get to drive around big fancy tanks, T-80s and M1s, and blow the crap out of stuff. And it takes like, The rule book is scaring people because it's 170 some odd pages long, but there's so much crap in there. To play the game, you need about 20 pages. And most of those 20 pages are examples and sidebars and designer notes, and all kinds of extra stuff. It's really, really a simple game to play.
Yeah, and I think the rule book's also in like 18 point type for us old folks.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. It's great. I don't have to squint anywhere. I can take my glasses off and read it.
Yeah.
The counters are beautiful. The maps are great. There's lots of maps. Holy cow. I've got the defense of Frankfurt scenario one out of my thing. It's 8 maps, huge. It's 39 inches by 57 inches is the whole book, is the whole scenario. It's a hoot.
So you talked about, like, you only need about 20 pages worth of space to work with here. I think folks generally understand the whole, you know, wargamers understand the general concept of the genre we're talking about. Cold War goes hot in Central Europe. So, like you said, T-80s, M1s, Abrams, BMP, you know, the BMPs, the Bradleys, got some helicopters zipping around. Not a ton of air integration because we're at the tactical level where, like, you're not getting... You might get an airstrike or two that you can pre-plan here and there, or some off-board artillery, but pretty much everything fits on the map. There's not a ton of stuff happening off map.
Right.
Yeah. For folks that have not played this before, though, core mechanics, general process, it's chip pull activations, although they've got, you know, cards now.
They have cards now. Yeah.
Where so you're randomly activating formations on the board. And combat resolution is a bucket of dice.
It's opposed dice, yeah. 4 dice against your 3 dice or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, but it's...
Can we talk about this game? Because, I mean, the combat mechanics are not the issue. I mean, this is a great game. It's very easy to play. It has some nuance to it, so...
Yeah, well, I was trying to cover the broad strokes for... Look, there's going to be some people out here that listen to this that might have seen conversations about the World at War 85 game and the series and everything, but they may not know sort of some of the underlying information about it. And so that's, we wanted to cover the basics, right? We're doing our due diligence here to set the stage.
This was a great game to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
we didn't cover the scope of the game and all that, but it was a great game to begin with. And it's been cleaned up. So,
well, it's not like you had to buy hard into it. You backed a Kickstarter, right?
Well, I backed it and it was the right thing to do because this is a good game and it deserved to be cleaned up. And it's been cleaned up and it's been enhanced. The maps are great. The counters have been improved. So I just want to make that clear. I mean, this was a great game to begin with, and it's only been made better.
Yeah. So we got platoon level counters, some single vehicles here and there, but mainly you're moving tactical level formations around. Vance, what's the scale on the Hexus? 250, 500?
250 meters.
250 for the Hexus. Not a ton of
5 minutes to 15.
Not a ton of elevation changes, some, but not a ton, especially not in the opening set. Storm in the Gap box came with, what was it, 7 counter sheets?
Yes.
And, and these
expansion
are the...
Expansion 4 more.
Yeah, the expansion's got more in there. One of the great things about the counter sheets is that the way Lock and Load is cutting these things now, with every counter is cut individually, so there's not a ton of residue that Vance doesn't have to clip his counters. And,
I didn't know what to do with my counter clipper now.
Yeah.
Very cleanly punched. It's amazing.
Yeah, like almost no nibs coming off on the sides.
I've done this because I played one of the intro scenarios. They come so cleanly off the sprue, it doesn't matter. There's no punching. There's nothing. I mean,
yeah, they just pop out.
Yeah, they just pop out. Exactly.
In fact, you can use the sprues as a way to store the counters.
Yeah, I was about to say, they pop right back in, too.
You actually can do that. If you're that pathetic, you can do that.
Hey, man, I use my Ziploc baggies.
You are one of the ones who uses those Ziplocs.
I am.
You didn't order the ammo crate, huh?
No. I can get everything back in the 2 boxes.
So the base box, the Storm in the Gap box, we got 7 counter sheets. We've got, what is it, about 20 maps total between
the base one, there's not that many.
Just the base one. Well, because there's 6. The green and the white.
Yeah, so there's 8.
Okay. So is that 8, that's 8 green and 8 white though, right?
No, that's 8 total. That's 4 green and 4 white.
4 green and 4 white, that's what it was. Okay, so
all
the
expansion.
Yeah, and that's the white ones are the same terrain as the green ones, it's just winter time, so, yep. You know, here's some snow camo for you. Vance,
but it's different though, no, it's not just the color, it's like your cultivated fields no longer count.
Yeah, because
so
it's game effects.
Big bowling alleys worth of shooting lane.
Yeah, it's and there are some mobility penalties on the winter sides as well, right?
Yeah.
So it's you're right. It's more than just cosmetic. You mentioned the rule book. Now, one of the things that I'll tell you, it freaked me out a little bit when I was first flipping through there. There are almost as many reference cards in the base box as there are pages in many rule books.
Yes. Can we talk about the reference cards? Because that game has more reference cards than I've ever seen in my entire life.
And, I know, it's just crazy.
It is
crazy.
Yeah, so Chris and I have talked about this before once or twice where we were talking about the reference cards. And first of all, I think it's really cool that they have tried to come up with anything that you might possibly need on a reference card. It seems daunting in that you take out there's an entire deck of reference cards. And,
that's a great idea, except you have 24 fucking reference cards.
Well, you don't use them all.
But that's the key thing. Like, Vance just hit it.
That's not a reference card, except I'm a reference card 12B.
Yeah. But Vance hit it right there. Like, you're not going to use them all. You find the three that you need for the scenario you're playing.
Exactly.
And you leave the rest of them in the box, and you're probably okay. I will say that there's a couple of them that it almost felt like sort of, oh, crap, we need another Kickstarter stretch goal real quick. We don't have anything prepared. Okay, throw another reference card in the box. And
throw a reference card in exactly.
And so we end up with the reference card that lists.
Leave my box, that's for sure.
Yeah, we end up with the reference card that.
Exactly. I'm like, what? Where the hell am I going to use this?
Yeah.
You have the reference card in front of me. Like, okay, I've had this reference card, but then I need like two other reference cards so you make this useful.
Yeah, I'm sure Dave's going to hate us when he gets around to listening to this too.
Like that.
So,
Brent, I do feel like we covered this in the in usable.
Yeah. Let's just set the stage for the audience here briefly. Chris and I did actually attempt to record a conversation around World at War 85 for a podcast episode that ended up being completely unusable because the network would not keep us connected on Skype that night. And there was no way I was going to try and edit five distinct separate recordings together with all the audio that kept dropping out. So,
and I was actually sober that night.
Yeah, which is all the more reason to redo this.
I know, it's bizarre.
Vance, you've got more games in this than any of us. You said it's been cleaned up, it's relatively fast playing. Talk with us a little bit about some mechanics where you've noticed something that is cleaned up or streamlined or goes a little easier compared to the previous World at War iteration.
I guess the cleanest thing is they've cleaned up how they've represented special abilities of different units. So instead of, underlines and dashes and asterisks and on all your shooting and armor values and whatnot, everything's been cleaned up. There's use of colors. All the numbers are very big on the counters because the counters are bigger too. The font is better. But
that's a low bar to clear. Let's be honest.
Well, yeah, that's true. They were pretty, but almost unreadable. But these are great. And, if your unit's got some kind of special ability, it's a colored triangle. And so everybody's just either got a triangle or doesn't have a triangle. And then it's just the color of the triangle sets what his special ability is. Whether you're, carrying, whether you're a recon unit or your, indirect fire unit or, different things like that. There's your armor value is a color to tell whether you've got composite armor or not. There's your movement. If you're a regular movement unit, you've got white movement. If you can go across water, it's blue for rivers. If you can transport people, it's green. It's really, really straightforward. It takes 10 seconds to memorize. And there's a chart that tells you what all these specialties are.
Wait, you don't mean to tell me there's a reference card with special abilities?
That's one of the ones I use. There's about three that I use. The sequence of play, abilities chart, and the terrain chart. That's it. Those are the three cards I use.
So help me out here. Because I'm spoiled by GMT. So, I mean, this game has a ton of charts. It really does. But wouldn't you like to have, like, a couple of charts that were just done in duplicate so everyone had a chart,
Yeah. They could have replaced some of the stuff they put with duplicates of the really useful ones. But,
sometimes it's nice to have a chart for each player. And this
Yeah, but that assumes that you have another
charts,
player.
But it's like one chart for everything,
Yeah, that assumes you have another player. For us that don't like, that don't like friends.
Some of us actually play these things with other people.
For those of us that don't like people.
It's apparently great. It's a wide number of our audience, as I know.
Exactly. But yeah, the mechanics are easy. Like each unit's got your movement points on it. There's only about four different terrain types, so everything's either one movement point or two movement points. You move along, and if you move, you can still shoot because this is modern weaponry, but you get a couple of demerits for doing that. It's a posed die.
The game itself is very simple.
Yeah.
The charts are very clear. There were definitely some times where I'm like, it would be nice if we each had our chart as opposed to me having 17 charts on my own.
Somehow I suspect Dave would make additional.
Most of the info, like all the combat info, is right on the chits. Once you've played for 20 minutes, you've got that memorized. So the combat takes seconds to do.
I was just thinking about the charts and
there's
a plethora of charts, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the audience.
Well, that's fair. I'm sorry. I'm out. Okay. And I'm just letting Vance talk.
I'm done now.
You realize I don't have a truncate laughter command on the audio editing software, so... You guys are killing me.
Well, apparently Bonsai Cat has bought this game and will play it sometime in 2025.
He actually bought that? I didn't realize that he got a copy.
No, I don't know. Well, whatever. I'm just bullshitting.
Yeah. All right, so, Vance, one of the things you'd made a comment about online in our forums was the issue of the activation where it used to be chit pull. Now we've moved to having a deck of cards to kind of randomize the stuff. So for whatever formations you got on the table, you pull their formation cards into a small deck of cards that you're going to shuffle and draw the cards each turn instead of pulling chits out of a mug like we used to. One of the points you noted, of course, was it's tough to shuffle five cards, right?
Yes.
You know,
yep.
when you've got so few cards in there, shuffling can be kind of a pain. One of the things that I've played with here, with some of those smaller scenarios is, I would just lay out all five cards in order rather than try to shuffle. And I would lay out all five cards and I just roll some D6s and just put them in order on the cards. And that seemed to help with kind of randomizing it rather than just trying to shuffle five cards together. That was a bit of an on the table hack that I came up with just to randomize the order that the cards come up in. Yeah, audience, feel free to steal that idea if you want to.
For the small scenarios with like four or five cards, I just place the cards on the table and you know, flat shuffle them that way. For this massive scenario I'm playing, there's 25 or 30 cards in it, so it's not a problem at that point.
Yeah.
But I'm seriously considering making my own chits to do a chit draw.
So,
well, that's back easy to the stuff to do. Can we talk about this? Because if you want to make chits, make the chits. I mean, I think this is a small point to argue about because I understand what you're saying, but I also don't think it's a game-breaking mechanic. And if you want to make the chits, make the friggin' chits. I mean,
oh, I agree. It's not game-breaking.
Yeah.
I'm just old and crotchety and like my old ways.
I know, but Brent brought it up, so I figure I'll rip on it.
Feel free. I mean, that's sort of what we do here.
I completely understand what you guys are saying, and I get, you know, when this, like, five cards, I mean, that's, you know, shuffle them all you want. It's still five cards. It's not a chip. And I played this when it was a chip. I think there's so many ways around this. You either play it as it is, or you come up with a chip pull mechanic. It's not that hard to do a chip pull, for Christ's sakes.
Well,
it's easy.
Well, here's the thing. The physical form with which you randomize the activations of the units is irrelevant, whether you're drawing cards or rolling dice and consulting a table or pulling chits out of a mug. Like, who gives a rip how you're doing it? The key point in the mechanic is not every formation is going to activate every turn necessarily. You could have some formations that activate multiple times in a single turn. You could go multiple turns without a formation activating. Although there's a cleanup mechanic in there to make sure you don't go too long.
The base game's always accommodated that, though.
Yeah.
The game itself, no matter what iteration we are on, has always accommodated that.
I'm just trying to make it clear to the audience that it's not, I mean, we're calling it a chit pull mechanic, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're drawing counters out of a cup like the original version of the game. yes, we're using a deck of cards to randomize activations.
I understand the perception that the card mechanic seems less random than the Chipple. I actually do understand that. I'm just saying, if you feel that way, you can go back to a Chipple. That's not that hard to do a Chipple.
Yeah. I'm not sure, like, it may feel less random. I'm curious, like, I don't think statistically. Vance, you're the big math brain in the crowd.
This is a whole other conversation. I mean, if we want to talk, like, is it more random, this and that? Well, that's a whole, this is like a friggin' religious conversation.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's probably not one we need to steer off into.
No,
either.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's piss everybody off.
There are plenty of ways to piss everybody off in other fashions, right?
The whole thing is,
we'll do an entire hour on whether or not Twilight Struggle is a war game.
The cards do actually feel less random than the chip. And I actually,
just when there's so few.
No, exactly. And I'm totally on board with that. It's just, in my limited Blizzard thinking, I'm not sure that that's an issue. And I, you know, and if I felt it was an issue, I'd go to a chip. I'd make chips and do a chip.
It would be interesting to see how long it takes for somebody to spit out an app to randomize the activations for your smartphone.
Sure. Give us a year. A year from now, there'll be something on BoardGameGeek where blah, 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 blah.
Well, somebody's already made an Excel sheet to do the do-your-own scenarios.
Yeah.
They've entered all the units already.
Yeah.
Well, you know what the beauty is? This is something that's been around for friggin' 15 years anyway, and now they've got a redo, and so there's going to be a whole other thing about the redo.
Not quite 15. It's been just over 10.
It's been a while, dude.
Well, 2007, Mark had the playtest copy of the game at Origins with him. And I think 2009...
I've owned previous iterations of the game, and I own the new one, so...
Well, yeah, it's just, I know that 2007, Mark had the playtest version of the game with him at Origins, because he and I were sharing a booth, and so I saw it on the table in the booth he and I were sharing with, that he and I were sharing that year. I think 2008, I don't know that it was back in time for Origins yet. For that summer, it's possible he had it that summer. I know by 2009 for sure he did have it, because I had my copies of it in 2008 when I was living in North Carolina. I just don't remember if it was before or after Origins.
I guess I bought it early because I've owned that game for at least since that time.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got the original Eisenbach Gap with the Death of First Panzer expansion in it. And then I've got...
I still have that copy sitting there.
Yeah. I've got it on the shelf, and I've got one of the other boxes. I think it's the Blood Bridges box. I think it's the UK expansion. Is the other one that I've got with me.
And to the credit of everyone involved with this, as flawed as that was, it was a great game, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why when the game got redone, I bought into it. I mean, I didn't buy into that game because it was getting redone. I bought into it on the strength of the fact that whatever flaws it had originally, it was a great game.
Yeah. There's an elephant in the room we haven't talked yet, and we need to cover it, and that is some of the original graphic design was, let's call it, controversial. See if that's you know, mellow enough to appropriate.
Well, I don't want to talk because the box art is still fantastic. I mean,
yeah, so
the counter sucked.
Yeah.
Let's just address that right now. The counter sucked.
The original counters with the typography that was chosen, and the counter size.
Blow my brains out right now.
Yeah, so they, as far as typography goes, it was evocative of the period. However, it was useless for imparting the information needed to play the game. And
if it's a yellow number 6 with a blue line under it,
yeah,
blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was terrible, horrible.
It was a combination of bad typography, bad color, and the counters were too small for the amount of information trying to cram on them.
I've been doing this for a long time. I've never seen a counter more dense with, like, bullshit information on it.
Oh, no. There are some out there that are more dense than those.
Well, I don't want to play those games, I can tell
and
you.
They're still only half-inch chits. Man, I've seen some half-inch chits that are just chipping back these days. That's crazy.
Now, that said, none of those others with more information crammed into them did so in an intentionally hard-to-read typeface.
No, they're all clear.
Yeah, they're all far clearer now.
Well, except for Band of Brothers, which is Comic Sans for some reason.
Going beyond that, the counters have been beat up ad nauseum. Like, we all know the original World at War counters were a complete headache. The original World at War maps were very functional. They weren't overly artistic, but they were functional. They did the job they needed to do in terms of providing the tableau on which you were playing, and that was great. The new ones, I think, look a whole lot snazzier. Thus far, I haven't seen any real difference in playability between the new ones versus the old ones. Vance, what's your experience been? Playability about the same with the maps?
They're about the same. I mean, these ones are really nice looking, but there are some areas that could be clear or stand out better. Some with the elevation changes, although they are marked with a nice white line. But there's the, you know, everything's just these two levels, except for the graphics on the map have got varying shadows to make it look like slightly rolling terrain.
Yeah.
Which is kind of distracting when you're trying to tell what the hell you're actually driving over. So that is, they're entirely playable.
Yeah.
It's prettier to look at.
The shading that you're talking about, though, it's artistic. It's not a game effect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's, some places it's a little hard to tell what's a game effect and what's just an artistic shadow.
Yeah, and I think many gamers, being the obsessives that they can be, assume that if there is something on the map, it must have a game effect.
Right.
And so you're trying to figure out, oh my God, what does that mean? And it's really just trying to look like some undulating terrain. You know, it's nothing much to it.
Once I stared at the map and realized that, then now I can see through that and play a lot easier. But it throws you off the first few times you play.
Yeah, you can see clearly now because the rain is gone.
Yeah.
You can see all the obstacles in your way.
It helps when I drink less when I'm playing.
Well, that no wonder Mirth's having trouble with it.
What am I having trouble with?
Exactly. One of the big pluses to the original series artistically is one that I'm hoping holds up or is continued, and I think is going to be, just based on what we've seen from the Kickstarter. The original series had a very solid series graphic design that if you saw a box from one of the World at War game series, you instantly knew what series it belonged to. The way the box was kind of partitioned into the two halves with the different graphics above and below, with the World at War logo in there, with the way that stuff was laid out, there was never any question in anybody's mind that box you were looking at belonged to that game series. So far, while the art is completely different on the new games, I think so far that standard, it appears that Dave and the crew there are setting up the new boxes to follow a similar standard, although it is different. It's still going to be one of those that as soon as you look at that box, you're going to know, oh yeah, that's one of the World at War 85 games.
Yeah, well, if you go to their website and you go to the sales page for Storm in a Gap, they've actually got pretty much all of the next box covers laid out. And
yeah,
they're all the same. It's basically a black box with a nice big splash of color and the name blazoned across the top. So it's going to be, they're going to have the same effect. You're going to know on looking at a shelf that's in a series that all belong together.
And to their credit, like Lock and Load's done that with their other series as well.
They did it with the tactical series.
With the tactical series, with the giant, you know, face portrait of, you know, the I don't want to say cartoonish art because that makes it sound childish, but the graphically rendered art like an oversized counter on every one of the Heroes of games, you know, with the Lock and Load tactical series. Those are all clearly in a series, even without seeing the title on the box. You know, just looking at the box art, those guys all belong together. This one's doing the same thing, and I think that's a great choice. You know, obviously it's a marketing decision. Yeah, I got that. But for the game players, for the guys that like to showcase these really snazzy looking games on their shelves, this definitely fits well within that.
And these all come in nice big 3-inch boxes, so you can definitely get all the stuff back in them. Even if you use counter trays, apparently, although you do need to say cramel crates if you go into those. But man, 3-inch boxes sure take up a lot of shelf space.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Just eyeballing the shelves I've got up here, I'm not sure I've got any war games that have bigger boxes. I've got a couple of, like the Mage Knight box. I'm not sure I'd consider Mage Knight a board game, but, or a war game. But the Mage Knight board game box that I've got, I think, is bigger than this. But there's not many others that I've got. The Mare Nostrum box from Academy Games, I think, might be a little bigger. But again, not by much. For war games, you've got to go to, like, the original Fantasy Flight Tide of Iron box to find something bigger than these.
Yeah, the original coffin box, yeah.
Yeah, that original Fantasy Flight Tide of Iron box, I used to joke, you know, when somebody's like, what the hell's in there? I'm like, aircraft carrier.
Well, actually, Flying Pig's OST games are in bigger boxes. They're in...
Oh, that's true. That's true.
They're bigger XY. They're not any deeper. They're only 2 inches deep, but they're bigger XY dimensions. They're,
yeah.
They're almost 11 by 17 boxes.
You got to store them flat on your shelf because you don't have a shelf big enough to stand them up on.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. But yes, a 3-inch deep box, it does take up some shelf space, but everything fits in there, which is good when they keep adding stretch goals to the Kickstarter.
So there's one other change that I think people should know about.
Lay it on us.
That's the formations no longer have a formation ID printed on the counters.
So Vance, how do you tell what formations are which?
Eh?
I was throwing you a bone there. So Vance,
yeah.
How do we tell which formations are which?
All the formation information is on these cards now. When you draw a card, it tells you the formation ID, and it gives you a color band, which tells you which color band units are on the map, which means that you could have the orange band units, say, be American. They could be, you know, 3rd Infantry Division one day, or they could be, you know, part of the 5th Corps the next day, or they could be some other, you know, cav units the day after that, and you can mix and match, which is nice because it gives you all kinds of abilities, because you on the card also is the morale for that unit, and its command range is good and reduced, which means you can have, by printing a different card, you can have the same unit have different stats because it's been overrun or it's brand new or it's, you know, green or experienced or whatever. So it's nice in that way. But it was kind of nice to be able to collect over the whole series in the old versions. You had a set of units that were, you know, cav units that were 8th Infantry, were 5th Division Armored, were,
well,
you know, 82nd Guards Rifle Division, that kind of stuff.
Well, you would have if they'd actually included complete formations.
Yes, there's that too. Well, you don't get complete, well...
Sorry, I did.
I'm skeptical of the whole thing, by the way.
What whole thing? About using the colors?
No, whatever you just described, I'm skeptical.
He's just skeptical because it's you describing it, not because he's actually played it.
I mean, it works, except like these really big scenarios. Like I've got, so now I've got, say, two sections of Russians that are both dark green, and they've got different ID cards. So you have to try and keep them separated in your head of which is which.
That's got to be fun.
Oh, I get what you're saying. This is kind of
it's not as hard as it sounds, because one formation is entirely T-80s and one formation is entirely T-64s. But you just got to remember which.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But T-64s are better than T-80s.
Not in this game, man. T-80s with their composite armor, man, you're not gonna, it's a pain in the arse to try and take them out with a tow.
Oh, trust me, I played the games.
You're starting to sound like Oddball, right? A T-80's got one weak point, and that is its ass.
Composite armor, man, that becomes your bane of existence in this game.
Jesus, I got my whole ass handed me in the friggin' intro scenario because fucking T-80s were better than the M1s at the time.
But they are. They have a bigger gun. The M1s in this game are the only
like
original
M1s. Narrow period where that was true.
Yeah, the older 105s left a little to be desired.
We're okay, yeah, but
just the punch. Gun level. I mean, you play those scenarios. The friggin' T-80 is like hosing the early M1s. I mean, they're not that competitive, to be honest.
It's the truth. Oh man, and when you can volley file with the Russians too, and that's awesome.
I know. Trust me, I covered the whole thing.
And you throw an HQ on top of that, you're a rolling death machine, dude.
Trust me, I'm like what the frig is going on?
Yep, I love it. It's great.
Yeah, I know. The Soviets were never that competitive, though, by the way.
Vance, you're letting your inner communists escape.
Yeah, but see, then NATO gets to shoot twice as often, so they cover themselves pretty good.
I learned a lot in that because when I got close and I was firing twice, I mean, oh my god, yeah.
That's what you got to do.
So, Vance, talk to us about the neoprene playmat.
I was trading shots at range. I wanted to get in close and just get my shots. I mean,
yeah. Well, Murth, sorry, you can't stick a bayonet on a gun tube.
I shouldn't have to be closing in with an M1 to be smoking TV. I shouldn't have to do that. Whatever. I'm not bitching. I mean, it's just...
Sounds like you're bitching.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, I'm bitching. Whatever.
You're drunk. You're bitching. That's what you do.
Because we'll play. And trust me, I'll close into knife fighting range with the freaking M1s.
Yeah, we should have a game over Vassal.
Yeah, I would do it. Definitely do it. I mean, I learned the hard way. I learned that... range weapons were, I mean, when I closed it, I actually was closing in up over a frigging hill with the T-80s, and I was just like, boom, 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 you're dead. But I wasn't doing range attacks with them, which was what I thought I should be doing.
Yeah, because somehow you needed to personally experience the idea that a bayonet charge with tanks is a bad idea.
It wasn't a bad idea for me. The M1s against the T-80s, you get in close, you're going to kill. And they're not necessarily going to kill. Not in these rules.
All right, Vance, talk to us about the neoprene playmat. Have you used it?
Yeah, the thing that's got all the admin stuff on it?
Yes.
It's got the turn charts and your dead pile and all your... Yeah, I use that. I don't use the cards that came with it. I use the mat.
So everything that's on that mat is somewhere on a couple of reference cards that you could lay out instead, right?
Yep.
It's just the neoprene mat looks cool.
You need to figure out which reference cards you need. Because you got like 20 of them.
But yeah, it works great, especially when you're doing a solo, because all the stuff's together, right?
The follow-up question, of course, is if you're using the neoprene playmat and playing anything bigger than the intro scenario, how big of a table do you need to put it all on?
Well, I'm playing the biggest scenario they've got, and it's taken up my 4x8 table.
Yeah.
For the big ones, you need a 4x8. I mean, if you're doing something smaller, you know, a normal table's fine.
Yeah, if you're doing
the big scenarios are big. I mean,
yeah, if you're doing a one or two mapper, then you know, something you can normally play a normal size GMT game on is fine.
Yeah,
but anything bigger than that, you're going to work for it.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah. It's just the neoprene playmat. I just threw out the two reference cards that had the key stuff that I needed for the couple of scenarios I was poking around a little bit. I did not use the neoprene playmat, in part because I'm too lazy to clean off the other half of my table where I would have it laid out.
Right now
what I have on the other half of the table is I've got a stack of Millennium Wars boxes that BC had sent me, and then I've got Tank on Tank cleaned up where I had been playing with that the other day. I said the other day, it's been like 2 months, but I've just been too lazy to put some other stuff away. And so at some point I will clean off the rest of my table and then can actually have the space to use the neoprene playmat. It just strikes me as one of those things that's, it's very cool. Like visually there's definitely some oomph to it. I just question the practicality of it given the amount of space it takes up on the table.
Well, yeah. Can we talk about that? Because I'll actually speak. I played the couple scenarios. I mean,
yeah, so what I'm wondering is how you can fit anything on your table with...
It's fantastic. It does take a fair amount of table space, and I don't think it saves you that much as far as, like, when you get into charts and stuff, it really doesn't replace that many charts. I mean, you're still fumbling... You can have that set up, and you can have stuff going on it, which is cool. And I think it works out very well. But it doesn't save you, like, charts and stuff on top of it. You're still fumbling around with the charts in the game, in my opinion.
Yep, no, I agree.
So, Chris, we're all wondering how it is that you can play a game on your table around the stacks of unopened, unpunched, still in shrink wrap games that you've got piled up in your
house. I don't play them in my house. I have other people that will play these things.
Bastard.
Well, okay then.
So I literally have around me, like, 14 games stacked around me, but I don't play stuff at my house. I go to other people's houses.
All right, Vance, the expansion box. There's three expansions in there. We've mentioned the Drive on Giessen a couple of times as the campaign expansion. Talk to us a little bit about what's involved in the Drive on Giessen.
Well, it's got two overall operation maps, one for the Soviets, one for NATO. And you kind of blind move your troops around on there until you run into the other guy. And then you move to the regular game and fight out the battles in regular. And it's kind of neat. It would work really cool as a double blind referee game in kind of even, you could even do it in the Kriegsspiel manner, because you could have multiple commanders with their own units trying to move around on the map and then blasting away at each other when they come into contact.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to work out a play by forum that I can do this on. It would be fantastic.
So you're talking about the operational maps, just so folks can visualize. It's almost a point to point movement on the operational maps between the locations where the tactical battles in the regular game would be fought out.
Right. And in the operational part of the game, you've got air units that can do recon and get information on the enemy, where he is and where he's moving. You can do airstrikes operationally to slow the guy down. You can have your artillery in the background so it acts as offboard artillery and doesn't get picked on too easy. You can do airstrikes against offboard artillery. It's pretty well thought out. The only thing about it is that it's kind of a do your own campaign. So they didn't give you a set TOE for each side. They give you, go ahead and buy a number of points for each side and work it out from there.
Can I say something in this regard? Because, I mean, I've been playing this game for a long time now, even before the reissue. And with the reissue, they give you the cards with the ranges for different scales if you want to do it as a minis thing. We actually, my friends and I, before this all happened, we played this game as a minis game, and we've done it as a mini campaign.
One of the keys with the campaign game, that Drive on Giessen campaign game, of course, is that the effects from the tactical battles are supposed to carry over back to the operational map. So when you fight one of those tactical battles, whatever your losses were, those carry with you into subsequent battles. So if you send somebody on that stupid Banzai charge over the hill and get them all wiped out, you don't have them in the next scenario.
Sure. I think the game allows for that, and I don't think it makes too much finesse if you wanted to adjust that, I mean.
Well, there is a repair and refit.
There is, but that requires effort on your part, and depending on how fast the next tactical battle comes up.
The fact that I think the original game had these elements there. I mean, I don't think these are new things, If you want, I think, whatever flaws the original game had, I think it was accessible as a campaign game. I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So I think that there's kind of a new mechanism in the campaign layer, is that they give you the ability to back out of a scenario. So you can actually, when you drive on and you start getting creamed, you can actually withdraw from a battle to try and save your ass for the next time, which is something that individual scenarios don't do. You grind yourself down to nubbins trying to get that last victory point, which, no real commander would do.
Probably not.
You want to avoid that fight? I guess you pay a penalty and all that. I find that very interesting. These are the things, I played plenty of games with these mechanics. I find them very interesting,
Chris, you're right that the original version of the game had the ability to graft on some sort of campaign-style mechanism like that. What the reboot has done and what the Drive on Giessen has explicitly done is not just given you the framework within which you can operate, but given you an actual, they've given you the ops level map, they've given you the specific, situations to happen along the way. So where previously you had a way to do it, but required a lot more work on the part of the participants to get there, here's everything ready built for you, and that's great.
Well, I am not trying to diminish that in any way. It's a new experience within the game, I'll be interested to see how many people follow that, you know. I appreciate that mechanism being there. I really do. I mean, because I actually, I'm a huge fan of, like, campaign mechanisms, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
All right, so the other stuff in the expansion box, one thing I want to note that I thought was really handy, and it was something that we'd actually done back in the Bayonet Games days, is I like the counter sheet of admin markers. Just one sheet of very useful admin tools that can be used for any of the games and any of the scenarios in there. I think that's a very worthy Kickstarter stretch goal to include in there. It makes gameplay very handy. I think putting an expansion box was exactly the perfect right place to have it.
And for these big ass scenarios that are in the Drive on Frankfurt thing.
Yeah. You need them.
They could have thrown in another sheet.
Yeah.
I run out of ops complete markers.
That happens.
So we've got Drive on Gießen in the expansion box. Vance, what are the other two in the expansion box there?
Is the Defense of Frankfurt, which is two monster scenarios with units. And, the Storm and Steel, the follow-on troops, it's Czechs and East Germans troops.
So it's the Russian sidekicks.
The only complaint I've heard and that I actually agree with is the color background for the Czech units and the East German units is really close together. If you have any kind of colorblind problem at all, there's no way you're going to tell these apart unless you look, try and discern the flag on the background.
Well, and
pretty hard.
And let's be honest, with some of the color choices in the overall game here, somebody with some color blindness is in trouble anyway.
Oh, yeah, for the stripes. They're going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I'll be your friend. I mean, apparently it's a friggin' biological issue. I don't distinguish well between shades, so. You know, brown and red look the same to me most of the fucking time, so.
Right. So there's a couple of those. Like, the Czechs are dark purple, and the East Germans are dark blue.
I'm sure that in a game situation, I could not tell the difference between a color.
Now, let's follow that up, though, Vance. How many of the scenarios have Czechs and East Germans on the board at the same time?
Yeah, you almost never have them both on the same, which makes it fine, but having them rolling around in a box, unless they're labeled, you're gonna have a hard time.
Well, exactly.
Picking the
problem. It's not the game, it's when they're in your counter tray.
That could definitely be a hassle.
The way I store my parts is everything with the same color band goes into a baggie and all of the cards with that color band go into the baggie as well. And the cards have got the names of the units on them.
Forget
so I can easily
baggie.
Tell.
I mean, Christ. I mean, that's how I separate things out into my counter tray.
Yeah, exactly.
The purples go here.
Yeah, but you're not putting the formation cards in the counter tray.
Yeah, whatever. Screw you. You're not playing these games anyway, so.
Well, but Vance's point is a very useful one, I think, for some of the audience in that if you're storing the cards in the baggie with the counters, it's very easy to read the card to know what you're pulling back out of there. And I think
nobody gets to store your cards with the counter.
Well, but it's not just that you already have the cards on hand for the counters that you're pulling from that Ziploc. It's that the card is an easier thing to read as you're sorting through the box trying to find the bags that you need. I think that's a good idea. Vance, the rest of the Kickstarter package that you received. So we've talked about the base game. We've talked some about what's in the expansion. We talked some about the neoprene playmat. Neither one of us have opened the shrink wrap on our solo game generator, and we know Chris doesn't have anything meaningful to say about anything involving a solo game. So we're going to blow right through that.
I've opened mine.
You've opened yours. And again, reiterating my point, I have nothing meaningful to say about a solo gaming experience. So let's move on. I think honestly, the biggest problem that I had with the novel was the fact that, the electronic copies that were emailed to everybody somehow made the ship go slower across the Pacific arriving in port.
We can talk about that all we want, but they're not very well written, by the way. I mean, I never cared about the you know, whatever. I have my copy. It's just not very well.
So I got the electronic, before the game ever arrived, I got the electronic, I got the ebooks for both the Storm in the Gap novel and the Space Infantry Resurgence novel. Yeah. And I spent my time reading the Space Infantry one instead. The Space Infantry book was actually pretty good. I have not yet even, other than moving it out of the way in the box that arrived, I have not opened the book at all. So,
well,
you know,
let me say this.
You made it one chapter in. I think Vance made it a little further.
Originally read the, when these books were originally written, there were werewolves and vampires involved. So I'll be happy to say that there are no werewolves and vampires.
How do you know? You didn't make it past the first chapter.
Well, I didn't like it when there were werewolves and vampires, and these books are, you know, at least they don't have werewolves and vampires.
All right, cool it. Vance, are there any werewolves or vampires?
There are not.
Okay, what did you think?
They're easy reads. Like I said, I listened to the audiobook version on my commute, so it was, they're okay.
They are easy reads.
Yeah.
Can we leave it at that?
Sure.
I don't mind reading about people I know about in certain parts of the book. That is.
I will accept they are easy reads, and I will.
They are easy reads.
Vance, in your Kickstarter box, did you get any of the other add-ons like the Spiral Bound books or the Folded Gap map or anything else? Any of the other bells and whistles?
I didn't get any.
Okay. So you got basically the whatever the base buy-in for the Kickstarter was that included all of the stretch goals.
That's correct.
Which sounds like the same thing I got here. Chris, I don't think you added on any of the bells and whistles either, did you?
No, I bought in at the earliest level and I got the book, all the stuff.
Yeah.
I have everything that everyone else has. I mean,
yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. Well, but some folks did the add on to get like the extra copy of the rule book that's spiral bound, so it's easier to flip through and reference
and
lay it flat and that kind of stuff.
I have a spiral bound book and I don't have like the metal dice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get the metal dice either. There's also a hardcover book of the rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
didn't spring for any of those. Not because I'm cheap, but because I really thought that the value you were getting for what you paid was already pretty fantastic.
I want to be clear. I'm not cheap. I mean, I've given these people money like several times over.
Oh, good God, yes. I think the Armchair Dragoons collectively have you know, spent a whole lot of money with Lock and Load over the years. I don't think.
Yeah.
There's anyone doubting the bona fides.
I spent a substantial amount of money with them. I mean, I was lucky. I felt lucky to get in at the level I did for the Kickstarter, but I've given them a lot of money over the years.
Yeah. We're right around an hour here. A bit of a shameless plug to throw in. This summer at Origins, the Armchair Dragoons are going to have the full. We've talked with Dave. We're coordinating with him. We're planning to have one of the big Folded Gap maps there, one of the big oversized ones. And one of the things we're doing this summer is we're planning on playing a multiplayer big battle on that giant map where we're going to have multiple commanders on each side plus a second level commander behind them who's going to be helping coordinate. You know, think of it as brigade commander, battalion commanders. I think we actually split it up as battalion and company commanders. And so those battalion commanders, they're the guys that are going to be controlling your offboard artillery, the availability of airstrikes, some particular resupply packages. So if you start to run out of ammo, we'll have the ability to push some resupply forward from that command post. And so the plan is, you know, 3 to 5 players on each side, sort of fighting their way through a really big battle that's got somebody coordinating the actions of multiple commanders on the map. That's the plan that we're shooting for this summer. If we don't get the big, massive Folded Gap maps from Lock and Load like we're hoping for, we're going to end up piecing together a whole lot of those little maps to make the one big map that we're going to fight it out on. But that's one of the events that we're planning to do this summer at Origins. So we are going to be showcasing some stuff from Lock and Load with us there this summer. I don't think it's enough to get Vance to actually show up this year, but we're going to at least make him jealous that he's not there. If we can do that. So that is something that we're going to have coming this summer. working on the more detailed review of the game, about halfway through the writing of that right now. Obviously, this podcast will be talking about it. Vance, have you managed to talk Cyrano into setting up a Saturday Night Fights with this thing at all?
I have not done that yet, but that would be fun. But first, somebody's got to build a TTS module for it.
Well, I thought Cyrano's cranking those things out like two a day at this point.
I'll have to talk to him about doing one of these. I'm not sure that he owns this.
Well, we might have to fix that. We'll have to figure out how to clean that up.
Yeah, it would be fun to do Saturday Night Fights with this. It would be a blast.
Yeah, totally. Anything else we need to cover on this thing before we call it a night and send the audience on their way?
No, I'm out. I have an angry girlfriend.
No, I think we covered it good.
Peace out, brother.
For anybody else that wants to take a look at some conversation on the World of War 85 stuff, swing by the Armchair Dragoons forums. Come pay us a visit. We're talking about this stuff quite a bit. In addition, keep an eye on the front page. We've got a review that'll be coming up in a bit. Again, going for a more thorough, detailed review on all of this, so it's taking us a little bit of time to make sure we play through a variety of scenarios, cover a whole bunch of different mechanics, make sure we get it all. And then, you know, Vance is always active in the forums talking about this thing. And if you didn't know, there is a pretty active World at War 85 Facebook group as well that the Lock and Load guys moderate. And, Vance, I've seen you in there quite a bit as well.
Yep.
Cool. Well, Vance, thank you. We'd say thanks to Chris, but he already hung up on us to go talk to his girlfriend, which I totally get. I'll be honest, I feel sorry for her since, you know, he's kind of tipsy at the moment. But good luck to him. On our next mention in dispatches, we're talking about the development of the Horse and Musket series from Hollandspiel. So we've got Doug is one of our Armchair Dragoons and also the developer on that series. And so he and Jim stopped by to talk about those games. Vance, by the time we release this, we'll have no idea what's coming up on Saturday Night Fights. But for those of you that want to watch some live non-nude wargaming on Saturday nights, tune into YouTube and come check us out on the with the Armchair Dragoons. Did we miss anything?
Nope.
I think we covered it all. Thanks, Vance. Thanks, audience. And we'll talk to you next time.